Bill. Good morning.
Morning, Tess.
So to start off with, humans, we've come to rely on many, many plant and animal species for our growth and survival over the years. How many species do you think are actually yet to be discovered? How many species do you think are out there that we don't know about?
Well, it's a bit embarrassing to say this because it makes biologists sound like we're all a little bit thick. But plausible estimate, well, right now we have about 1.5 million species that we know of, which have been so-called described scientifically. They have a scientific name. We know about them. They're cataloged, et cetera, et cetera. The current estimates right now, plausible mainstream estimates, range from about 500,000 to 50 million additional species that we don't know about yet. And most people probably are going higher rather than lower in terms of those kinds of estimates.
So there's a bit of a big net there. There could be pretty much anything, basically. A lot, I think we can go with definitively there. A lot.
Yeah.
So biodiversity, it's a super important aspect of biology, obviously. Why is it such an issue that we may be losing so many of these species that when before we actually have the chance to discover them?
Well, as biologists, we kind of take this stuff for granted. But when you start thinking about it, everything from our crops to most of our pharmaceuticals to many of the kinds of, practical things that we use either come from natural ecosystems or they're derived from natural ecosystems. Nature's had millions, in fact, billions of years of evolutionary creativity in order to create biologically active or pharmaceutically active compounds that have all kinds of functions. In fact, much of what we actually do in modern biochemistry is not to invent new stuff. It's actually to mimic stuff that we found in nature that tends to have natural functions. And we haven't, again, because we're just scratching the surface. I mean, who would have cared, if the rosy periwinkle would have gone extinct in Madagascar? It turns out the rosy periwinkle was the inspiration. In fact, for a long time, it was the only known treatment or a drug from that, the only known treatment for childhood leukemia. And the list just goes on and on. We know that we live, for instance, with our agriculture, we grow these giant monocultures of giant, huge stands of wheat or barley or maize or oil palm or whatever. And we know that these things are constantly under attack from a whole range of different kinds of pathogens and diseases. And the thing is, these crops are basically genetically uniform in most cases. They're clones of one another. So if one thing gets attacked by a disease, everything does. So we need to have those genes from their wild relatives, which in many cases, for instance, with wheat, there's scores of different wild species of wheat living in its former geographic range. We need to have that new genetic information to try to interbreed with these crops in order to give them greater resilience. The list just goes, we could spend hours talking about this, the different kinds of products, the kinds of unharnessed uses that we have for all the natural products out there. And this doesn't even include things like, carbon storage, producing clean water, limiting floods, regulating the climate. I mean, the notion that we're somehow independent of nature is a very dangerous idea. You hear characters like Donald Trump and some of the perspectives you get out of a guy like that. And what it really makes you realize is, quite frankly, I have to say the word ignorance is about the only thing that I can apply to this notion that we're somehow independent of our planet. We're a product of it, and we rely on the healthy biosphere very much for our own health.
I do have to ask as well, Bill, how do we actually go about finding species and then determining that they are extinct? I know very little about biology. I kind of want to know the mechanisms of how that works.
Well, it's the old unknown unknowns thing, but so if we've never discovered a species and it's gone extinct, well, we're out of luck because it just vanished. I mean, the best case scenario might be you'd find a fossil of the thing or something, subfossil or something somewhere, and you realize, oh, oops, that thing had gone. We didn't even know it was there. But in most cases, these things are just vanishing without us ever knowing about it. And we know that this is happening. I mean, we know that if we put an insecticidal fog up into the rainforest canopy, we know that we get a rain of insects coming down and that most of them are not known, are completely new to science. We know that everywhere we looked, I mean, I had a friend up here in North Queensland whose mother-in-law's cat, and he's a biologist, and his mother-in-law's cat went out, came back in and had this funny looking animal in its mouth, and he looked at it and he said, Now, hang on a second. That doesn't look like any mammal I've ever seen before. So he wrestles it away from the cat. Lightning strike me if I lie. The cat went away, came back with the second one of this thing. And later, believe it or not, said it was very hard. But the third time it came back with another one. He chased down all three times. Turned out to be a completely new species known as a prehensile-tailed rat. Now known to be relatively common in North Queensland, but they never enter wildlife traps, so we never had any way of catching them. So for a long time, the only specimens we knew about this thing were the three individuals caught by my friend's mother-in-law's cat. Everywhere we look, we're finding new things. There's some biologists in India that spent 1,100 hours digging holes in the ground, and finally they stumbled over the first Sicilian, which is this really strange snake-like amphibian that lives underground. The first one ever seen in the Indian subcontinent. Not only was it a new species, it was a whole new family of Sicilian. I mean, we're stumbling over this stuff, you know, all the time. But the thing that's really scary is this. A lot of these things, the reasons we're not finding them is because they only live in very small places of the world. And there's certain parts of the world that are climatically unusual or have been isolated in the past or for whatever reason, tend to have really high concentrations of species that live in very small areas. We call these places centers of endemism. And there's 35 of these recognized centers of endemism around the planet that are, well, they're not just centers of endemism, but they've also been trashed by humanity, in which at least 70%, oftentimes more than 90% of the original habitat has gone. And so we recognize these as hotspots, biodiversity hotspots that are incredibly vulnerable. This, in fact, is where we're finding a lot of these new species, and these areas are incredibly vulnerable. So Madagascar is an example, the rainforest of West Africa is an example, the Brazilian Atlantic forest, for example, and the remnant rainforest of Eastern Australia, in fact, is the very last, the most recent biodiversity hotspot to be added to the list because there's so much biological uniqueness and many, many restricted endemic species in these areas. And so the point is, the places where we're seeing the highest concentrations of new species are also some of the very most vulnerable places on the planet. That's why we're so nervous about what's going on and hanging on to these last vestiges of vegetation in these areas, of native vegetation, is just so critical. It's so absolutely critical. It's if there's one thing we can do as biologists is to say this, let's not squander the natural wealth of the planet in order to have just a little bit more agriculture or a little bit more development or a little bit of intensification, especially in these biologically crucial areas that we know so much of the world's unknown biodiversity resides.
A very, very powerful and a very important point there. Do we know of any notable species that we've actually discovered after they've gone extinct?
There have been things that have disappeared before scientists really had a proper chance to look at them. Things like the stellar sea cow, which is, you know, like this massive manatee. I'm sure if I think about it for a while, you know, there have been things that disappeared that people, I mean, the dodo, for instance, I don't think was ever really properly studied by scientists. Specimens were eventually sent to places like the Natural History Museum in London, that type of thing. But I don't think scientists never really properly had a chance to look at them. So they were described scientifically after they disappeared. And it's really been going back after the fact to try to figure out how did that bird behave? What did it eat? You know, how all that kind of stuff. So, yeah, and we know, for instance, now that I think about it, the Polynesians, as they expanded across the Pacific over the last couple thousands of years, are known to have driven about 1,800 species of endemic island birds extinct across the Pacific. So these would have been things that, again, we wouldn't have been able to study, but we would have worked out from, remnants of the bird that would have been preserved in some way or another. They might have been subfossils or they might have been parts of a wing or something that would have been found in some kind of human dwelling, that type of thing. So, you know, yeah, there's been a lot of biodiversity that disappeared. We also know, for instance, that the original, Paleolithic hunters, the humans that spread across the planet, with the exception of Africa, which is where the humans evolved, everywhere the early humans went, they killed off a lot of stuff. I mean, they killed off the mastodons and the mammoths and the giant ground sloths in saber-toothed tigers in North America. They killed off all kinds of things in Europe. In Australia, it was everything from giant predatory kangaroos to goannas the size of Komodo dragons to huge, absolutely monstrous pythons to diprotodon, which is a big marsupial, a plant-eating marsupial that was the size of a hippo. In New Zealand, they killed off the moas. In Madagascar, they killed off the giant elephant birds and the ground sloths. I mean, again, this is all stuff that's been worked out later on by, you know, New Zealand, for instance. You can find these areas where there's just giant piles of these moa bones and areas where huge numbers of the shells were eaten and left behind. So we find these things that, again, they're not called fossils, they're subfossils. They're sort of, they've been around for centuries, but they haven't had a chance to fossilize. So yeah, you know, Tess, there have been a lot of things that have been worked out later on that we never had a chance to study, to look at their biochemistry, physiology, behavior, you know, to in any way possibly use things that they did as biological inspiration. I mean, there's many, many things that we've, you know, Velcro would be one example that came, that was inspired by biological insights and many other things as well. So there's a whole field of science now that's called biomimicry, basically based on mimicking things that natural systems and biological species do and learning to create new inventions on that basis. So, yeah, you know, the more we learn, the more we really realize is that humans are, the impact is accelerated mightily in the last, you know, 50 to 100 years because human populations are just going through the roof right now. Conceivably, we could have 10 or 12 billion people on the planet before very long. And, of course, our technologies have changed. Our consumption is increasing. As developing countries become more consumptive, like the industrial countries have become, this is where things are really dangerous. We're seeing a lot of the most rapid changes happening in these very rich tropical and subtropical regions of the world. So we've had this enormous acceleration of habitat loss and species loss, but we know that humans have also been having an impact for pretty much ever since they've left Africa at least 100,000 years ago, and certainly in the last 50,000 years and to the last 10,000 years, we've seen really dramatic impacts on the megafauna. So we're a very smart, adaptable, intelligent, exploitative species, and we're doing things that all species do, but we're doing it right now in a pace and a scale at which nothing that has ever been on the planet Earth in the last 4.5 billion years has ever even come close to doing. So it's all new territory right now.
And I think that is a brilliant note to end it on. Bill, thank you so much for joining us on The Daily this morning.
A pleasure, Tess.